We're building the best internet talk radio on the planet.
I'm sorry, this is effective when?
It's effective now.
TalkZone.com.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, and along with Eric Edholm, it is our pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen, both on and off the football field.
We'll discuss some players with some off-the-field issues and start our positional breakdown for the NFL draft.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us again this week for Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor, along with senior editor Eric Edholm, my co-host on the radio show during the offseason. Wayne Larrabee will rejoin us in a couple weeks as we get a little closer to the NFL college draft. Also, the entire Pro Football Weekly editorial staff will be along over the course of this show in the next hour or so. But we start, as we do each week during this locked-out NFL offseason, with an update on the NFL's labor impasse. And for the first time since March 11th, the two sides met this past Thursday, April 14th, under court-supervised mediation. Representing the NFL owner's position was the commissioner, Roger Goodell, along with Robert Kraft and Jerry Richardson and other lawyers. On the player's side, D. Smith was there with his attorneys, Ben Lieber, the linebacker from the Minnesota Vikings, Mike Vrabel, the Chiefs linebacker, and, of course, Carl Eller, representing the retired players in the suit. And they've got a pretty good muzzle on this one, Eric. The judge, Judge Nelson, has insisted that this all be kept confidential. Both sides, including those notorious tweeters, George Atala for the players and Greg Aiello for the owners, have managed to stay silent. We're not going to know a lot about what's going on in these sessions, nor is it really important that we do. What is significant about these mediation sessions is there's really no other way to spin it, but this one is a bit of a victory for the players. They absolutely wanted to stay in federal court. They are in federal court with an appointed mediator who is a federal judge. The owners very much want it out of the courts. They want it back to Washington, D.C. And I think what's really important here, not so much that they're talking to Minneapolis in federal court, but Judge Nelson has clearly said that she disagrees with one point from David Boyce, who represents the owners. She does feel she has jurisdiction in this case.
Yeah, and she will eventually come down with a ruling on the injunction. Of course, we know, as we talked about last week and the week before, it will be appealed, and that process we understand. But another victory for the players. If Nelson were to grant the injunction, I think that would at least slant things a little bit more in favor of them right now. And we can't really give them a victory at this point. What's interesting, too, is that really this is the first time that Goodell and D. Smith have sat down since March 11th, the day the lockout started, and deem it progress, deem it something, whatever you want to say. Even if these talks don't go anywhere, it's good to have these guys in the same room, and maybe they can sort of kick back up some of the progress that they made last time.
Well, and one of the points, and again, I think it was Judge Nelson who made this point, because one of the owner's arguments was they were wasting 16 or 17 days worth of mediation with George Cohn, that the Federal Mediation Service in Washington, D.C. was familiar with the issues. And her point was, yeah, and look where that got you. You know, Maybe it's time to get a fresh set of ears in there. It doesn't take that long to get familiar with the issues, and so it'll be curious to see if these mediated sessions, and that's all they are, is mediated sessions. It's not the mediator who matters here. It's the two sides. But perhaps this mediator will be able to push them in a direction that gets them a little closer to talking about an actual settlement.
Yeah, I think everybody assumed that when, you know, the venue was had not been decided about where this mediation might take place and before Judge Nelson had actually ordered it, the players said, look, we'd rather have it under federal supervision here in Minnesota. And everybody said, look, you know, they like the courts. They want to be close to the courts. That's where their victories have come from. But I think you're right on your point about the first time around. They didn't get anywhere. You know, I mean, they made some progress on stuff, but there was no real progress when it mattered. And so I think they have a point about having some different ears, having some different folks push them, use some different tactics to push them in different directions.
Well, and it's interesting that we say they made some progress, and they said they did early on, but in the end, on March 11th, when they walked away, they were further apart than they'd ever been, and they have new gaps to bridge at this point. I think the other thing, and we've tried to just present the facts for all of our listeners, is that beyond where one side or the other is more comfortable, even though the owners have promised the players that they will not use these talks in any way to hinder their antitrust case or to suggest that the union decertification is a sham, even though that continues to be one of their claims, there's no ignoring the impact of these conversations. And so by keeping them in federal court, the players are stating clearly we're trying to negotiate a settlement to a lawsuit. We're not negotiating a new CBA. I don't doubt when the owners say that they will, protect them against any damage from these conversations, that that's their intent. But the owners have made promises in the past that just haven't been kept. I mean, we heard about the players possessing an affidavit from Paul Tagliabue at the time they signed this agreement in 2006 that the owners would never try and stop them from decertifying again. And we have to believe it's true. A number of players and union reps have alluded to it. Obviously, the fact that the owners gave Tagliabue that affidavit doesn't mean much to them now. So, they can promise to protect the players all they want. Players cannot afford to be negotiating outside of court because of the appearance it would create.
Imagine the public outcry and what the PR, movement that the players would do if the owners went back on the word on this. Imagine how much on the attack they would go after this, and that would, I think, sway some public opinion even more towards the player side, which is where I suspect things are kind of going now. I mean, I think that's fair to say.
Well, Sports Illustrated did a poll about 10 days ago that clearly showed there was more tolerance for the player's position than the owner's. Well, I don't think anybody's too happy with either side.
Yep.
And I think the more people you check, that's that's the sentiment you're going to hear the most often. I think the other thing that is most significant about these mediated talks is that we have a better feel for what the real sticking points are and were, because all along the owners were really trying to be smart and I think throwing up trial balloons and hiding what their real issue was, this idea of another $1 billion in givebacks. Well, they quickly negotiated that down to $650 million. Then they said, we'll split the difference and make it 3.25. It was never what they really wanted. What they want to do is they want to cap the players' participation in future profits and future revenue growth, and they made in their last offer some suggestions that were quite frankly ridiculously insulting. What's interesting about this position, though, is it's much more defensible for the owners, because you can't ask the players to give back revenue, share in the cost of operating the team, but we're not going to let you share in the equity. But what you can say is if you're not going to share in the cost, you have to have limited participation in the profits. And they now at least have a much more defensible position. The question is, where are they going to come down in terms of what the really numbers are?
Yeah, and there's also this talk about redistributing money from rookie salaries. This has been a little bit of a talk this week about that, and giving some of it to veterans, but it sounds like the agents aren't too thrilled about that too. It sounds like, some of these top picks are going to lose a lot of money, and the distribution may not be as favorable to the veteran players as they had hoped too. So shifting the money around here, it sounds a little confusing, but I can tell you that there's some wiggle room there with what the owners had offered.
Well, and I think the real problem there is it's no different from trying to decide if you like the Republican deficit slashing or the Democratic deficit slashing. We know what they both say they want to do. We don't really see the particulars too much in it. You don't know how it's actually going to come down. When you look at this rookie wage scale, everybody agrees it's something they have to do.
Yep.
Now, the owners have said we're going to save $300 million. They've said it's going to go to current and retired players. They haven't said how.
Right.
And we don't really know at what pace, where the money's going to come from. So there's more to be discovered there. Everybody wants to slash the deficit. Everybody wants to keep rookie salaries down. The devil is in the details. And right now, at least from the NFL perspective, we just don't have enough details about it. It is going to be part of a new collective bargaining agreement. They will roll on. They will continue to talk. We will keep you up to date as best we can with limited information coming out of the mediated sessions. We know a lot about what's going on with the draft and NFL teams, though. We've got that coming up next. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm in studio. We are now joined on the hotline by Associate Editor Arthur Arkish. And Arthur, teams and players not talking much this week, but one of your clubs, the Tennessee Titans, certainly very much in the news. Kenny Britt, a mercurial young star wide receiver, possibly a future All-Pro, if he can stay on the field and out of jail long enough. I mean, this kid just finds trouble like you wouldn't believe. His fifth run-in with the law in just the last year since the Titans selected him with the 30th pick in the first round, I should say in the last 2 years, was charged with eluding police, lying to an officer, and obstructing governmental function. First charge is a third-degree felony. The latter charges are misdemeanors. He's scheduled to appear in a Hudson County, New Jersey courtroom on April 19th. A long list of problems prior to this. What are the Titans to do with this young man?
Well, that's a great question. As if the Titans didn't have enough on their plate trying to find a quarterback and get a head coaching staff acclimated to their new club, they have a Kenny Britt situation on their hands. Now, as you mentioned, this is this is nothing new in terms of him being in trouble with the law, but we're hearing that while their patience is indeed being tested, that they're not expected to do anything drastic. They're certainly not going to release the young man who still has several years left on his contract and is considered the future for them at wide receiver. So where do they go from here? What we're hearing is that, again, they're not really expected to do anything drastic. They may look at a receiver in the draft in the later rounds, but as I already mentioned, obviously quarterback pressing needs, several pressing needs on the defense. They're not expected to, you know, use that number 8 overall pick on a wide receiver as a result of this.
But, you know, Arthur, this kid has shown flashes of brilliance, and you've got a rookie head coach in Mike Munchak, who some question is even ready for this challenge, can't even talk to the kid right now. It's going to be a very interesting test for Munchak.
No question. It's a difficult spot, and it's going to be interesting to see how Munchak responds. Now, this is not his first offense, as we mentioned, so he is expected to receive some discipline from the league. So it becomes a question of if Coach Munchak decides to, you know, put another slap on his wrist after that, if they're just going to have a conversation about this young man's terrible decision making, or you know, what is the next step.
The other issue that stands in Munchak's way right now is the fact that he doesn't really have a quarterback. I mean, Kerry Collins could be re-signed. We obviously know that that there's really nobody on this roster right now that projects as a long-term starter. Arthur, what are they going to do besides keeping a rookie quarterback away from Kenny Britt in the meeting room? What do you think their future plans are as far as possibly drafting a quarterback in the next couple weeks?
Well, we're hearing there is a definite interest in Jake Locker. Our draft expert, Nolan the Rocky, does not have him graded out quite that high. He's considered a mid to late first round talent. The Titans, of course, have the 8th overall pick. So if they can find a willing partner and are able to trade down and still grab Locker, we're hearing that's something they may be interested in. But you got a few other teams, the Vikings at 12 and some other clubs who may be interested in his services as well. So that's one name we're hearing. Christian Ponder is another name we're hearing that may fit closer to their second round pick at number 39 overall. But these are two guys that are definitely on the radar in Tennessee.
Arthur, the Jacksonville Jaguars, another one of your ball clubs. Owner Wayne Weaver can't seem to get his foot out of his mouth. At his season-ending press conference, he said, "I will tell you, we will be in the playoffs next year. I don't think there's any doubt about that." Quote, this past week, he said his team is still 1 or 2 years away from competing at the highest level and indicated that Jack Del Rio would not be back if the team doesn't advance to the playoffs next season. So what is the story there?
Well, the story is that Mr. Weaver has a hard time handling the public image of his club, and this isn't the first time that we're hearing this, but, you know, you appreciate the honesty. Clearly, this team is not ready to make that kind of a jump next season. They've got some nice pieces, but what's interesting is that while he did say they're a couple years away, it does not necessarily change the fact that Del Rio really is in his final opportunity in 2011. As we all know, Weaver elected not to renew any of the assistant coaches' contracts, which really is going to put Del Rio in an impossible situation after next season if they don't reach the playoffs, because he's going to have to go find new guys, which is going to be difficult. So what we're hearing is it's still playoffs or bust for Del Rio.
All right, Arthur, thank you very much. We now welcome in senior editor Mike Wilkening. And Wilkie, the Cleveland Browns, interesting list of celebrity young college men coming to visit them. They've had two wide receivers, both A.J. Green and Julio Jones, in for visits in Cleveland. One of the two probably will be there at number 6. They've also had defensive ends Daquan Bowers and J.J. Watt, both pretty sure to be there. Bowers might not have been before the knee questions popped up. But then another name on the list, apparently Cam Newton's been in Cleveland. That one, a little bit of a surprise to some folks.
Well, the Cleveland Plain Dealer reporting the visits that they had this week on Wednesday, and Cam Newton's a guy that has drawn their interest. Quarterbacks are always going to interest Mike Holmgren, so certainly that influence is all over the sort of homework and due diligence that they have done. They have a young starter in Colt McCoy, whom they like, but, you know, we're going off of less than a full season of starts with him. But that position is always something that Holmgren's going to take a keen interest in, so it's not surprising that they're doing their homework at number 6 with him. But when it comes down to it, guys, they have some real needs along the defensive line. They've switched schemes, and they've got a big need at wide receiver as well, because they really need a playmaker at that position.
Well, that was going to be my next question, Wilkie. And we look at the defensive line. They're switching fronts, and this is Dick Duron's show now, and he's favored a 4-3 front a lot of times, and this is what they're doing. I don't see any defensive tackles on that list, and it's a deeper class at that position. In the final 20 seconds or so, is it possible they come back in round 2 or 3 with one of those spots?
I think it's possible. What I do know is when you look at their situation, anybody that they would bring in, I think, would have a chance to play and play immediately, given the makeup of the roster and given the fact that we have a new coordinator and a new scheme in Cleveland. So I think when it comes down to it, they're going to be looking at guys both inside and outside in that four-man defensive front that can play immediately in Cleveland.
Mike, thank you very much. We're going to take another quick commercial break here, but we got lots more way we hear it around the NFL. Some news on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Chicago Bears this week, both individually and collectively. We'll talk about it in a moment. Pro Football Weekly rolls on with more way we hear it, all the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen from around the NFL. And we now welcome in Associate Editor Dan Parr. And Dan covers the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, amongst other clubs. And Dan, Aqib Talib, it's a mess right now. And the Bucs, there's going to be obviously some time off before any trials, any charges. It appears that his mother may be in even a little deeper than him. But the bottom line is that this is not the first time he's had trouble since he became a Tampa Bay Buccaneer. He was troubled in college. He is an outstanding young cornerback. What are the Bucs to do here?
It's interesting, Hub, in the immediate aftermath of Talib being charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, that happened March 21st, there seemed like there was a rush to judgment that the Bucs needed to part ways with him, because as you said, he has had some past issues and has really a bad temper, it would appear, and is prone to making some really poor decisions. A lot of people thought it was time for the Bucs to part ways. Obviously, they could not with the lockout at this time, but there were people demanding that when football does resume that they get rid of him, and I think that over time, emotions have settled down in it. From what I'm hearing, the Bucs are not rushing to this decision. They are not eager to part ways with Talib. It could turn out that they'd make that decision, but right now they're really considering their options, and I think there's a pretty good chance that he's going to be a Buck when the 2011 season begins.
Now, and it would seem to be completely different items, you know, something that doesn't relate it to the next thing. But Mark Dominic, the general manager, has done a really nice job there rebuilding this team. He got a 4-year extension. Raheem Morris, I know, after a really rough first season, had an outstanding year last year. Seems to have the respect and of the players and the ownership alike. Do you think a suspension is ordered? I mean, now these two guys have been kind of emboldened by their positions with the team. I mean, could they send a really strong message to Talib, considering just how young this roster is?
I think that's a possibility. But the thing with Dominic that has really helped him is that he's been willing to take chances on some of these guys with character concerns. Mike Williams, a wide receiver, falls to the fourth round last year. Ends up becoming probably the most productive rookie receiver in the class. LeGarrette Blount, a guy who was undrafted, again, character concerns. Yeah, punched a guy during his college days at Oregon in a game atmosphere, and turns out to be one of the best rookie running backs in the league. So Mark Dominic has taken chances on these guys, and it's paid off so far. He did not draft Talib, but a strong suspension could be in the works if the Bucs decide to go that route. I think the league may end up instituting that punishment, though. Like we said, Talib, not a first-time offender of the personal conduct policy.
You know, definitely a story worth watching, though, because what it's paid off in is the best record amongst non-playoff teams in the NFL. You get a locker room with LeGarrette Blount and Mike Williams and Aqib Talib and others, and at some point, sometimes that can become a very dangerous situation. Another curious story, and I know the Chicago Bears, another one of your teams, Dan, this really caught me a little bit by surprise. And I don't know if it's official yet, but there were reports everywhere that, assuming there is an NFL season, the London game this year will be the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Chicago Bears. Now, if my memory serves me correctly, this will be the second time in 3 years that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers have played in this game, a game which Commissioner Roger Goodell supposedly wants all these teams to play in. I have to assume there's some connection to the Glazers' ownership of the Man United soccer club, and why are the Bucs going back so quickly?
Apparently there is a fairly strong fan base for them overseas, and I think that's part of the reason. It does, at first glance, seem a little bit odd. This is a team that hasn't been in the postseason, that hasn't had postseason success, not America's team by any means, but apparently it is London's team now. So yeah, it's an interesting situation for the Bucs, but they'll take it. They like the, you know, Malcolm Glazer thinks globally, and he's getting the opportunity to showcase his franchise.
Well, we know private citizens in Great Britain are not allowed to own guns, so it's not the Aqib Talib fan club. We'll keep an eye on that story and see how it develops. Chicago Bears, last time they were in London, 1986. I actually went with them. It was the year after the Super Bowl in 85. That's not the big story for the Bears. Lovie Smith has said his club will be one of the least affected by this lockout because they're a veteran team. One of the veterans people are wondering about, though, is Devin Hester, who is paid like a number one wide receiver, has never performed like one, and in fact took a step back this year.
That's right, Hubby. He was down to 40 catches for 475 yards. A big dip for him in the first year in Mike March's offense. Now, a lot of people are wanting to see what are the Bears going to do to get this passing game turned around. Ranked 28th in the league last year, And part of the process for the Bears is determining how best to use Devin Hester. I don't think you're gonna, I think the whole storyline of him being a number one is just about dead at this point. They want to find ways to give him more chances to make plays with the ball in his hands. That's ending up to be a pretty difficult thing to figure out for them.
All right, and Greg Olsen, their tight end, another player who's going to have to be re-signed soon. A little tough for the Bears right now because he's still not the complete tight end they would hope, but clearly became a prime target for Jay Cutler last year. Dan, thank you so much. We want to welcome in executive editor Dan Arkish. Dan, a lot of people worried about the future of Larry Fitzgerald in Arizona. This is the last year of his contract, and yet right now he apparently is not acting like a guy who wants to leave the Cardinals.
Absolutely not, Hub. He got back from a trip around the world, and he decided to take it upon himself to get a lot of his teammates on the phone, and he organized some team workouts that are taking place at the Arizona State practice field, a surprisingly good turnout, up to about 25 to 30 guys, and it really attests to the growing leadership role that Fitzgerald has taken on for the Cardinals. You know, there still is the great possibility, him being in the final year of his contract, that he could look elsewhere if that quarterback situation isn't to his liking, but this type of an action certainly doesn't seem to indicate that.
Yeah, and Dan, a nice move bringing in retired wide receiver coach Harry Sullivan, one of the more respected guys around the NFL. Obviously somebody that Anquan Boldin definitely benefited from and something Fitzgerald could benefit from. Is he telling management, look, I want you to take a veteran quarterback over somebody with the number 5 pick? Has he given their input? Do we have any indication about that?
In a perfect world, Eric, and in Larry Fitzgerald's perfect world, he would have a proven commodity throwing passes to him and accurate passes at that. I think if he had a choice in the matter, he would love for them to go after Mark Bulger, hoping that maybe the ex-Ram would catch fire in the desert the same way that Kurt Warner did. And I think he would much prefer that to a rookie. And I think at the end of the day, he would love to stay in Arizona, but it's hardly a slam dunk.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for your work on that story. We will check back with Dan next week and pretty much every week. Right now, a quick commercial break, and then we'll find out what's going on with the Cowboys, the Jets, and the Bills up next.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
We are, and we are talking NFL way we hear it as 32 clubs get ready for the NFL college draft, trying to figure out where they're strong, where they're not, and what to do next. And the New York Jets have been in the news this week. Our associate editor, Kevin Fishbane, the Jets are one of his clubs. And Kevin, the story about interest in Randy Moss, and what's really intriguing about it is the question, are they interested in Randy Moss because of the contribution he can make to the Jets, or are they interested because they're concerned about the contribution he might make to the New England Patriots if they don't keep him away from them?
Yeah, that's the give and take with it. And at first they said Jets were interested, and there was a report that they're not interested. I think a lot of it does have to do, for one thing, Rex Ryan supposedly is a big fan of Randy Moss, but then people are saying he only did that to motivate Santonio Holmes. You know, Holmes and Braylon Edwards are both set to be free agents, and Santonio Holmes was pretty vocal last weekend that he's not pleased. He hasn't gotten a long-term offer, and he said he wouldn't sign his tender right now. So in the one sense, you know, if Braylon Edwards, who's got that Randy Moss height to him, if he leaves, they might want to look at Moss. And there are a lot of rumors that Moss could one day end up back in New England because we do know how much he loves Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. We do know that rivalry, so they may want to keep him from him. But right now, it doesn't look like he'll be heading to the Meadowlands anytime soon.
Interesting little anecdote, guys, at the owners' meeting when Rex Ryan was talking, some of the Patriots reporters who had nothing to do because Bill Belichick skipped the meeting. But aside from that, they asked Rex Ryan about Randy Moss, and he first looked over to Bruce Spaeth, the PR guy, as if to say, you know, is this tampering if I talk about him? So just an interesting little anecdote, keep in mind. But are they worried about Santonio Holmes is right now? I mean, where his head is? I mean, he said he won't sign the tender. I mean, do they feel like, you know what, we better have a strong plan B in case this guy becomes an issue?
He's the one that they want to keep. Out of him, Edwards, Brad Smith, another guy that could be a free agent when all this is said and done, Santonio Holmes is the guy. I mean, he's the X factor of those guys. He's the most talented, especially when it comes down to the red zone. I think last week should cause a little concern, and would it be a shock if they get a wide receiver at some point in the draft just as some insurance, but I gotta assume they're gonna do their best to keep on to Holmes. I think he'll be their number one option.
I gotta tell you guys, I understand he's a former Super Bowl MVP. He's a great talent, but when you look at his off the field track record, you gotta be real careful about multiple years with guaranteed dollars there. So I think that there may be a little more than smoke here on the Randy Moss story. We'll keep a very close eye on it. Real quickly, one of your other clubs, Kev, the Buffalo Bills, GM Buddy Nix told ESPN earlier this week he wants his first round pick at number 3 to start from day one. I don't think they've ever been serious about Cam Newton, in spite of what other people think. But does that pretty much quench that, or should say, put the fire out on that one?
That's what you would think. When I first heard him say that, I said, there you go. No more Cam Newton talk. But, you know, Buddy Nix is the king of smoke screens, people like to say, when it comes to the Bills and the draft. And if the Bills believe, after all their research, that Cam Newton could start over Ryan Fitzpatrick, which again would be a leap because they've been very positive about Fitzpatrick all offseason, then they would go ahead and draft him. But that statement made it look again more like a defensive player. A lot of people say Von Miller is a perfect fit for them, and Chan Gailey worked with them at the Senior Bowl. So you never know it with Buddy Nix in this, but that made you think they'll lean away from going with the quarterback at number three.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. Eric, one of your clubs, the Dallas Cowboys, a great story this week, and I'm not surprised it was DeMarcus Ware. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him a couple times, one of the real class acts in the NFL. NFL players who've been on rosters for 2009 and 2010 are eligible next week to start receiving payments from the NFLPA up to $60,000, a strike fund that was built by withholding player dues over the last couple of years, or I should say player shares of revenue that they earned from their licensing deals. DeMarcus Ware has said he's not taking his. He doesn't need the money as badly as a number of other players around the league, and he says he's talked to a number of other veteran players. This is a brotherhood. This is our message, and my hat's off to DeMarcus Ware.
Yeah, one of the more impressive young men in the NFL, and it has nothing to do with the fact that he's got $40 million guaranteed to him, as much as possibly $79 million in terms of the extension he signed in the last year or so. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's one of the player representatives to the NFLPA. He made this decision on his own. He's a sharp young guy. He's going to be one of the leaders on the Cowboys, and boy, it might be smart to pair him and Dez Bryant up and put him in a room and talk about leadership and responsibility, and maybe Ware can rub off on him because Dez has had a tough offseason. So
it'd also be fun to see if Dez came out in one piece, because DeMarcus yes. Ware is one tough hombre, guys. We take another quick commercial break here. It's draft time. We're going to bring in the best. Nolan Naraki will break down quarterbacks, running backs, wide receivers, and tight ends right after this. Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm bringing you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly on the radio. And we now welcome in the outstanding independent talent analyst, the most outstanding, I should say, in the country, Nolan Naraki, of course, senior editor at Pro Football Weekly, author of our NFL Draft Preview book, most respected voice in the business outside of the 32 NFL teams. You can give us a call at 1-800-FOOTBALL, toll-free, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if you'd like to get a copy of Nolan's book. And Nolan, draft now less than 2 weeks away. The clock is counting down. We want to start some positional breakdowns. We're going to start with the quarterbacks, and I think anybody who's interested knows at least a little bit about Blaine Gabbert and Jake Locker, Cam Newton, Ricky Stanzi from Iowa, Colin Kaepernick from Nevada, Christian Ponder from Florida State, the top six on your board in that order. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other kids. Beyond those six, are there others who you think might have a future in the NFL?
Well, the one guy you didn't mention, Hub, is Ryan Mallett from Arkansas. I'm not a big fan. I think he's very stationary in the pocket, but you can't deny that he's got a very strong arm. I think the intangibles are a concern. I think the offense that he came from is questionable, and there's some reasons he could struggle in the NFL, but he's a guy that could get looks as early as late first round, maybe even in the second. So he's a guy that's definitely on the radar of scouts.
Would you put Andy Dalton in that same category? Because he seems to be a guy with a lot of momentum. He's been impressive in team interviews. You know, maybe he doesn't have the ideal height, the ideal rocket arm, but all the intangibles seem to be there. Do you see him also possibly working into that late first round area?
Well, Andy Dalton from TCU and Christian Ponder from Florida State, I think the two of them are very similar players. They're dink and dunk West Coast passers, and I think they both could be top 50 picks. Personally, I'd like to get them in the fourth round. I think they're better backups than starters, but, you know, guys like that are hard to find, and I think teams have got excited about the intangibles.
Well, Nolan, those are the names that matter, but a couple other kids who I've heard about in various places that I'm curious about, T.J. Yates out of North Carolina and Mike Hartline out of Kentucky, a big, kind of ponderous, slow-footed pocket passer. Any future for either of those two guys?
I think they're more number three quarterbacks, you know, at their best, you know, maybe they're backups in the NFL, but Yates did have a strong senior season, put himself on the map, and he led North Carolina to a solid season, surprisingly, and I think he's a guy that has a chance in the NFL as well.
All right, Nolan, now as far as the running backs, I'm not going to call it a weak group, but you get past Mark Ingram, and you got a lot of guys a lot of people haven't heard about here, so tell us who the top five or six are as you see it.
Well, I think Ryan Williams from Virginia Tech really stands out. He's very competitive. You know, he didn't run the greatest at his pro day workout, and I think there are some concerns about his speed. But, you know, you put on a tape, and especially look at last year, and I think it's very clear that he could be a solid between the tackles runner. Mikel LeShore from Illinois is another one. He's got great size, great strength, tested very well. I question his the instincts and the vision. I think those are issues that are going to affect him at the next level. Shane Vereen from Cal is another guy that, you know, he's a solid runner. I think he's gradually moved his way up the board. And Kendall Hunter from Oklahoma State is another one that, you know, I really like. I really like the run instincts and vision, and I think he could be a solid pro as well.
Well, if you like the small, quick guys, this is probably the draft for you. And Nolan, you know, you and I were talking in your office the other day, and a guy who you said kind of had polarizing views from NFL people, Deion Lewis from Pittsburgh. I mean, he only barely measures out at 5'6" and change, but he's got a nice stocky build as far as his body is concerned. Seems to slip through the cracks. He's only 21 years old, put up big numbers at Pitt. Talk about sort of the debate both sides with Deion Lewis.
You put the tape on and you see a good football player, and that's the argument for him. You know, he's a guy that played hurt this year, and I think that's part of the reason there's been such a polarizing effect in the evaluation process. You know, he's a guy that's received anywhere from second to sixth round grades, and I think the teams that downgraded him tend to look at the tape where he was unhealthy and wasn't at his best. So I think that's a big part of the reason there's so many wild opinions on him.
Two guys who are clearly undersized, one of whom I know you like a lot, Jaquez Rogers from Oregon State, and Jordan Todman of Connecticut is a guy who I saw be pretty productive in a couple games.
Yeah, he was very productive. The question with both of them is whether they're going to be able to withstand the pounding that comes in the NFL. I think Rogers is a guy that's continually overachieved throughout his career, and you know, you always know what you're going to get with him. You know, he may go as far as the fourth round, but you plug him in the NFL and he'll find a way.
All right, Nolan, I'm going to ask you to hang on for just a minute. We've got to take a commercial break, but we've got some wide receivers and tight end prospects to break down for our listening audience. We will do that right on the other side of these quick commercial messages.
Plus, my revolutionary blender bottle, absolutely free. But you have to call 1-800-398-5322. That's 1-800-398-5322.
Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly as we visit with our senior editor and lead talent analyst, Nolan Naraki. Nolan, of course, the author of the Pro Football Weekly Draft Preview Guide, not a more respected voice in the industry outside of the 32 NFL teams. And Nolan, at wide receiver, it's kind of the A.J. Green and Julio Jones show. Once you get past those two, again, I'm not going to say there's not good football players, but it's a somewhat nondescript group this year.
Yeah, I think throughout this receiver class, you could find some solid players, but you got to value them right and know where to get them. Randall Cobb, I think, is a guy that's going to fit into that top 50. Very good in the slot. I think he's a dynamite player. And, you know, he's probably the next one off of the board. Jonathan Baldwin from Pitt as well. You know, I think he's a guy that's going to get overdrafted. He's a very athletic downfield target, and I think he's got the numbers that will push him up the board, but you put on the tape and you're disappointed.
What do you make of a player like Greg Little from North Carolina? I mean, he's obviously, he's got the, you know, the size you want at 231 pounds, seems to run pretty well. And yet, maybe outside of a West Coast offense, he isn't a great fit in the NFL. Where do you see him fitting in?
I think that's the right place for him. You know, he's going to be a solid Z in the NFL. You know, he's got great size. He's got good speed. He's a guy that has run after the catch ability. And I think he'll be a great fit in the West Coast offense. The big question is whether he's going to be able to stay focused and be able to gain the respect of his teammates in the locker room. I think those are both issues that could affect his stack.
You know, the interesting thing about this group, everybody now wants a Calvin Johnson and Andre Johnson and Brandon Marshall, that guy 6'1", 6'2", 6'3", maybe 210, 215 pounds. A.J. Green at 6'3.5", 211. Julio Jones at 6'2.5", 220. They fit that mold. You mentioned Jonathan Baldwin. Again, other than that, this is a group of smaller slot-type guys.
Yeah, there really are a bunch of them. Greg Salas from Hawaii is another that I think will be very good in the slot. Titus Young from Boise State's another one that could make a solid living. You know, he's got the speed and, you know, he could make a living outside the numbers. Vincent Brown is another one I like from San Jose as well. I think all three of them could be solid NFL players.
It seems like the last couple drafts have been very good at the top, or at least at the second half of the first through the end of the second round at tight end. This year, again, not real exciting, and Kyle Rudolph and Lance Kendricks out of Notre Dame, Wisconsin, respectively. You've got a couple guys with bottom of the first to second round grades. After that, though, it's not exactly a loaded class.
It's really not. This is the weakest class I think we've seen since 2005 when there were only 10 drafted. There's a chance there may be 10 or 11 this year as well. You know, Virgil Green from Nevada is another one that could be drafted in the first three rounds. But, you know, that's really it. I think there's three guys this year, maybe Luke Stocker from Tennessee as well. But it's very thin overall.
Oh, that's the guy I want to talk about, Virgil Green. I don't know what they feed these kids out of Nevada. You got Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback. You got Dante Moak, the pass rusher. Exceptional athletes. And then you throw Green out there. And he's, I would say, right in their caliber of athletic prowess. And yet, is he a tight end? I mean, is he more of a kind of a move guy, an H-back? I mean, how do you see him fitting in the NFL? And where do you think he should be drafted?
I think the third round is the right place for him, but in this class, he's a guy that could go around sooner. You know, he's an explosive athlete. I think it's the great thing that Nevada's done in recent years. They've recruited explosive athletes, and he's definitely got it. You know, he tested over 40 inches in the vertical jump, and he's a guy that can get up the field and make something happen.
Nolan, Rob Hausler out of Florida Atlantic comes with a number of questions, chief among them, Florida Atlantic, the competition. But you're talking about a young man at 6'5", over 6'5", 250 pounds, clocked 4.5 in the 40-yard dash. Seems like he could be a seam splitter. Is that totally a reach-type pick, or is there something more exciting in his future?
I think he's a developmental prospect, and I think there's a couple in this class. You got Jordan Cameron from USC and Julius Thomas from Portland State. I think all three of those guys have a lot of upside. Thomas only played 1 year of football, you know, came from the hard courts, and I think Cameron's even more intriguing. He's the guy that could be the sleeper in this year's class, similar to Jimmy Graham last year.
All right, Nolan, thank you very much. Nolan will be back next week as we break down the offensive and defensive lines, get the linebackers as well. Right now, we've got to take another commercial break, and the Publisher's Pen is right around the corner.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much. And you know, as we get closer to this year's, the 2011 NFL College Draft, I'm always puzzled by the question of how much do you weigh character, off-the-field concerns, football intelligence versus IQ, the Wonderlic test, all the things that you can't measure with a stopwatch or a scale. And the bottom line is when you look at this draft, I don't remember a time where we've had more of the top players with bigger question marks. Of course, it starts with Cam Newton. Pro Football Weekly's talent analyst Nolan Rocky got quite a bit of pub a week or two ago for a rather scathing report about his off-the-field issues. What nobody focused on was he said he was a great talent who may be a great quarterback, but you just don't know about investing a top 10, top 15 pick in a guy with so many questions, and they're all his questions. He's left a trail of things behind him, indiscretions that you just can't ignore, but it goes deeper than that. Nick Fairley, you look at Marcell Dareus, guys who could be, you know, primo defensive linemen, also off-the-field questions. You've got the knee injury to Daquan Bowers. These guys could be the four best players in the draft. I'd be surprised if any of them go top four with all these questions. It is something that we like not to focus on because we don't know all the facts behind it, but the reality is if you're a GM and you're picking in the top five or ten and you use a pick on one of these guys and blow it, it's the kind of thing that costs you a job. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, our executive producer, Syndication Network, our home studio, and most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. Join us again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly.